Well, I don't know about you, but I haven't had an ear infection for a long time. But I remember the last one I had. I was a lot younger, but I was in a lot of pain for several days, actually. And since I know that made me uncomfortable, I'm sure if your pet gets an ear infection, it's going to be uncomfortable. Larry Mueller here again. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine back once again. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
And I want to let you know, as you listen in, you can call in with your own experiences. Maybe it has to do with dog bites, maybe, or cat bites. Maybe it has to do with ear infections. Maybe it has to do with something else. Give a call. Number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And I know Sandy and I always love to see the pet photos that come up on our Facebook page. So if you've got a pet photo, please send it, fire it up there on Facebook, the Facebook title, The Larry Mueller Show. You can also post questions there as well. And this whole business, ear infections aren't any fun at all.
They aren't. And, you know, what's funny is that our pets, being pets, often don't show us any sign of having an ear infection, and sometimes we have to be the investigator to find out, where's that smell coming from? Or maybe, you know, maybe all they're doing is still eating, drinking, playing, but maybe just shaking their head a little bit, or maybe shying away when you want to touch their head. So I think part of being a pet owner, and the reason why I brought this topic up is, as most listeners know, I have three dogs, and they're the ones that tell me when one of the other dogs has an ear problem, because they start sniffing it or licking it, and then I'm like, oh, I haven't looked for a day or two, I better look in there. And then I see a red ear canal, and I'm like, oh, I'm such a bad owner, you know, that my dog has to, the other dogs have to tell me that there's a problem, but they're like, what's that smell, you know? So and so really, you know, paying close attention to your pet, and this is for cats and dogs, looking for, you know, is the ear flap red? And there's usually a normal ear to compare it to. So, you know, look at the one ear, compare it to the other. If the ear is swollen, the ear canal, you may see actually the canal looking narrower. Obviously, the dog and the cat ear canal is very different than ours. It's J-shaped. It kind of goes in and then makes a right-hand bend. So all we're able to look at when we're just doing a superficial evaluation is that top little bit, and what's down in deep and next to the eardrum is out of reach unless you're really good with using an otoscope to be able to get in there. So
that's where you come in, and your colleagues.
That's where I come in, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if you do notice your pet having an odor, discomfort, redness, obviously it's something that you want to bring them in for, because just going ahead and throwing an ear cleaner in an ear like that, if the eardrum is ruptured or there's a foreign body or a tumor in there or something, and a lot of ear cleaners are ear cleaning drying agents. They have alcohol in it. And you can imagine, if you've ever had a cut and had alcohol go on it, it stings. And you're putting that in that ear canal, it may be really, really painful for the pet. So before you start cleaning, I'm glad owners want to be proactive, but sometimes when they clean, before they come in to clean the ear, before I see it, I miss that chance of seeing what is causing it. And so it's kind of like cleaning your house before the cleaning company comes. You know, it's like, what are you going to do? You know, so rather than you jumping in and cleaning it, get them into a veterinarian. What we do for diagnostics is, one, we look in the ear. And two, we do a thorough body evaluation, since many dogs with ear infections have other problems going on with their skin as well. A lot of them have allergies. And so don't be surprised if you're going in for an ear infection and your veterinarian is looking at your dog's feet. You're going, what? I came in to have this ear looked at, and why are you looking between their toes? But we often look for signs of infections or inflammation other places as well. We will look in the ear with the otoscope, like I said, take a sample, and this would require putting a swab in there and collecting some of that material so we can do Actually, a couple of things. We'll often look for parasites. Ear mites are actually fairly common thing that gets misdiagnosed. It's kind of a brown, crumbly discharge, but it doesn't have to be. I had a dog in the other day that both the dog and the dog's housemate have had kind of chronic recurrent ear infections. They're both poodles that go to groomers. And she's like, I just can't get rid of this. And I took a good swab and actually kept looking and looking, finally found ear mites. And so we treat the ear mites and the infection's going to go away. So we'll look for parasites, we'll look for bacteria, we'll look for yeast. And so that means having a microscope handy. And depending on what we find, we may even submit it for a culture because there's some types of bacteria that we see resistant bugs with. I just had a vet student in the other day who had a dog that when we did the cytology, it came back with the type of bacteria that are rod-shaped bacteria, and it was resistant to just about every bug, every antibiotic we could throw in the dog's ear.
Wow.
And so if I had just picked something and said, here, use this, we would have been in trouble. So I had to pick a very specific medication to be able to treat that dog's ear. So it's just one of those things where, you know, don't mess with it at home. Get it looked at. The bugs can change. It may be a yeast infection one time and a bacterial infection another time.
And the bacterial infection just comes from?
Well, that's a good question. The causes of ear infection may be anatomical. We see some dogs like Cocker Spaniels that tend to be greasier. They tend to produce more oils and things, and they have those droopy ears, and so they're kind of greasy and moist, and so they get more issues with their ears. Some dogs have excessive hair in their ears, like the poodle-y type dogs that can trap moisture and make them have a better environment for infections. I had a dog in the other day that's an older dog that had a tumor in its ear, benign tumor, but it was just one of these, an odd spot for a skin mass to occur, but it was in the ear canal, obstructing the canal and not allowing good air circulation, and the dog ended up needing to have some surgery done to remove the tumor so that we can then get the infection under control. We see foreign bodies in the ear, things like grass seeds and things, but probably the number one reason is allergies. You know, dogs that have allergic skin disease will often have these kind of smoldering, warm ears that are a perfect environment for bugs to grow.
So for preventing this, I mean, there's not a lot you can do, is there,
well,
or is there?
There is. I mean, so in the case of something like a Cocker Spaniel that's just kind of greasy, routine ear cleaning may be very helpful. Using something that's going to have a surfactant in it that will help break up the grease. Dogs that have allergies, some of these dogs do really well on just intermittent chronic steroid ear drops to keep the redness down so that they're not inflamed and then they're not as warm, they're not as moist, and go from there. Dogs that are swimming, you know, using, while the ear's healthy, a routine cleaning drying agent may be helpful. But these are not things that you want to be doing on your own and picking a product just willy-nilly.
Yeah.
You got to know what you're dealing with, and this is where your veterinarian's going to be able to help you.
So lots of good advice there. Well, we have callers online who want to visit with you, and I think Terry in Eau Claire has something that relates to another topic we were going to cover, so let's go there. Terry, thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Yes, I had something I wanted to run by Dr. Sawchuk. Some young family members of mine adopted or rescued a lab retriever mix from a shelter about a month ago, and they just fell in love with this dog. They were told that it was 6 years old, but I can see some white on the muzzle. Things were going great the first couple of weeks, but in talking to them last night, I learned that this dog has bitten household members three times, two different people, in the last 2 weeks. And I guess I can think of like three options, you know, wondering if the dog could be treated with an antidepressant for irritability or anxiety, or does it need to be returned to the shelter, or does it actually need to be, or is euthanasia? I guess I'm looking
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the first thing is they need to get a diagnosis to try to find out what's causing this. You know, it may be that this is an older dog that maybe is painful and has some arthritis and are maybe hearing impaired and startles more easily. It may be that the owners just aren't able to read dog body language, and we see this happen all the time where, you know, maybe a child goes over and touches a dog while they're sleeping and the dog wakes up and licks the child. That doesn't mean that the dog is kissing the child and like, oh, I'm so glad that you're here. It might mean that, but it could just mean kind of a displacement, appeasing type behavior that we'll see with dogs that are anxious. And maybe, hey, I really don't want a kid to touch my feet, but the parents are interpreting it as, oh, isn't that cute? The dog is kissing our child. Or that they see the dog's tail wagging and assume that, oh, that's a friendly dog. All a tail wag means is that they are alert, and it may not mean that they are, you know, easygoing and want you to approach. And so that's where working with an applied animal behaviorist to actually go in and be able to help the people to get a diagnosis as to what's going on. Before that even starts, the dog should have a thorough physical exam and some blood work to make sure that there isn't anything going on like hypothyroidism that can make them more irritable. That they don't have arthritis or anything like that that can be treated medically that may make the dog feel better. Obviously, we don't just start throwing drugs, psychoactive drugs at a dog without a diagnosis. And so if it is diagnosed as an anxiety-based disorder, yes, we may be able to get by with using certain classes of anti-anxiety drugs. There's some that we would want to avoid that may take the dog's inhibitions away. Things like the Valium and Xanax and those types of things can actually make a dog go, hey, you know, I'm more willing to bite because you've taken away some of my inhibitions. So we have to be very careful with what drugs we choose. And we can never guarantee that this dog won't bite again. If they're looking for, you know, a guarantee that this dog's going to be perfectly safe in all situations, we can never, ever, no one can ever give you that guarantee. And so you're going to be looking at a lifetime of living with this dog, being always cautious, and, you know, in certain situations and so on. And, you know, what to do with it? If they aren't willing to make that investment in not only time, energy, and money to be able to get this dog treated, it may need to go back to the shelter. And it may just be that they were a wrong fit and this dog may be better in a different type of household. Obviously, they have to be very truthful with the shelter that this dog has bitten. It lowers the chance of this dog being adoptable again, but at least it gives the dog a chance and maybe they're able to find the right fit for it. I can't say that this dog needs to be killed at this point because I don't know enough about it. But unfortunately, that is the path that many of these dogs go if they're considered to be not adoptable. And I think this is too early to tell yet. So, they should, you know, again, contact their vet, contact the shelter. Maybe they can get a little more information as to the dog's background, why it was relinquished in the first place, and kind of take it from there. Yeah. I'm so sorry. This is a really tough situation to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, Terry. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, John Munson is in for Kathleen Dunn, and he and his guests are going to talk about a new form of design that combines architecture and ecology to address population densities and climate change. That's all at 2 o'clock. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. One open line left at 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, we're always looking for those great pet photos on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'll turn next to Chris in Stevens Point. Chris, hello. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Thank you both for doing this show. We have two cats and a dog, and our youngest cat, who's charcoal gray, has what I would call kind of semi-bald spots above her eyebrows. They don't seem to bother her, but they've been there for about a year and a half. anything to be concerned about? Should we buy Katie Rogaine?
Oh, thanks for giving me a laugh. No, they don't, there's no such thing as Kitty Rogaine, but you know, all cats have that hairless area that runs from the corner of their eye up to their ear, and that is a normal area where they can have very, very thin hair, and that's where they have a lot of scent glands. And so when kittens or cats go up and facially mark things, they have an easier way to do that because there's less hair to get in the way, and that glandular material can be deposited. What you're describing sounds like spots, like more like right above the eye. And there, you know, cats do have little kind of eyebrows there where there's just a couple of coarse hairs that are coming out if you look carefully. Mm-hmm. You know, and if it's not red, it's not irritated, the spots aren't getting bigger, it's bilaterally symmetrical, meaning it's on both sides of the eyes, it may just be the cat's normal hair distribution. If it's a new thing where they had hair there before and now they've lost it, be looking for things that may be causing facial itching where the cat may be rubbing more to cause hair loss. But, you know, again, with if it's, you know, always been there, it's, you know, not changing, it may be nothing. But the next time you're in for a wellness appointment, it would be something I would bring up with your veterinarian. They may want to, you know, just do some cytology, make sure there isn't a parasitic problem. Again, I would expect if there is any infections there, it would be spreading. You'd or your it. Other cat would have it too. Yeah. So
there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Darcy in Joliet, Illinois up next. Hi, Darcy.
Hi. I have a dog that is part Papillon, part Rat Terrier, part Springer Spaniel. And since we got him from the Rescue Foundation, he had a little patch of hair. And we never noticed it until recently. We didn't recognize it as a problem. A little patch of hair on the top of his head. Now, as he's getting older, he's just over a year old now. He is actually going bald on top of his head and behind his ears and also in on the back of his, towards his butt. He also has another situation going on where he's itching a lot. Now, we've had him into a dermatologist, and we're doing a diagnostic test with Rain dog food to find out if it's food allergies. And he's halfway through that diagnostic food test. I had him in yesterday because I was really getting concerned about the hair loss. And she suggested that it might be a folic disorder and has him on melatonin. It's a concern for me because I still see chunks of white hair. He has a beautiful tail, and every once in a while I'll find like locks of tail hair. Wow. on the floor. Hmm. So,
yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, Finn? Usually dogs, like, I mean, we do see some kind of genetic things that can cause alopecia or hair loss in dogs. And usually they're not itchy, though. They just start losing hair. And there's a condition called alopecia X. We can see, you know, like things like seasonal flank alopecia. There's all these things that are out there that can affect different dogs. But the fact that your dog is itching makes me think that there's something else going on there, that it's not just a follicular problem where they're just not growing hair anymore. And so, you know, I'm sure the dermatologist has done things like ruling out external parasites like Demodex and scabies and have gone through all the treatments for those. Done fungal cultures. You may be getting to a point where to get a diagnosis, you may be looking at having to get a skin biopsy done. And for skin biopsies, it's a pretty easy thing to do. We use just a little local anesthetic and a little skin punch that looks like a little kind of circular scalpel blade, and it's just like usually just takes a small piece of tissue, and that gets sent into the lab, and they're able to look at the hair follicles and look at the skin surrounding all the tissue surrounding it, to be able to get a diagnosis. If they haven't done yet that may be your next step, because you're obviously, if you're working with a dermatologist, they're going by the book and looking at everything that they possibly can, and that's really kind of the last thing to start looking into.
Yeah. So there you go.
He is on Apoquel.
Okay.
Also.
And Apoquel is an anti-itch drug. It helps block the itch receptors kind of at the nerve endings, and that works very well for dogs with itch due to allergies. It okay. doesn't work well for itch due to parasites. It doesn't work well for itch due to skin infections. Although it will help control the itch, it's not treating it. It's kind of masking it. And so for allergies, obviously, you know, we use that all the time, but we do have to get these other things out of the way. And so, boy, oh boy, I wish I could see your dog and have one of my dermatologists there. This sounds like one of those patients that me being kind of in a general practice in the vet school, I'm so lucky I can just walk around the corner and there's like three boarded dermatologists and I can say, what do you think? And a lot of times even they scratch their head because, you know, dogs can't tell us what's wrong and we have to just go about it very systematically. So don't stop what you're doing with a dermatologist and don't be surprised if they want to do some more testing too.
There you go.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for calling. And on to Pam in Green Bay. Pam, hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Thank you for having me on.
Sure thing.
All right. I have two 15-month-old cats. I've had them since they were very young. The only time they've been in a car has been when I took them home from the shelter, taking them to vet appointments or to get shots, and they don't like it. I am going down to Florida for a month in January, driving with a friend, accompanying a friend, and she said I could bring the cats. We could keep them in kennels in the car, but that's, we're staying overnight, two nights on the way down there to get down there. I've been trying to find somebody in the area, a relative that could keep them, but all of my relatives that like animals are overextended with animals.
Okay.
So my question for you is, what would you suggest in this situation? It's a long time. I hate to leave them in a not ideal situation.
Sure.
For that
yeah.
period of time.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that if you have the time, you can get your cats kennel adapted. And that's going to be your first step, is getting them used to being in the kennel. So often what we do is we only have the cats in their kennel when they're going in to visit us at the veterinary clinic. And so they associate car rides with something is not fun is going to happen. And so have the kennel out, dismantle it, put blankets in it, make it be a cozy spot, start feeding your cats in the kennel, maybe have the door off of it, gradually put the lid on it, and then and start maybe going for very short car trips where maybe you're just sitting in the driveway reading the Sunday paper, sitting in the driveway with the engine running, and it's somebody can be back there giving the cat treats through the cages of the door, and just trying to get them adjusted to being in the car. You may want to talk to your veterinarian if you don't have that kind of time with using some type of an anti-anxiety medication that is going to make your cat feel more comfortable. There's natural things you could use, like Feel Away, that you can spray the kennel with before you put the cat in it, and that can be used every day, a couple times a day, and that may make the cat feel more comfortable. And then we look at prescription medications, such as like gabapentin was a drug that we use fairly commonly now for travel, and that's a very safe drug to use, and it gives the kitty just that, they're just very calm and mellow in the car. Make sure that if you are taking them with you, that you use a big enough kennel that you can include a litter box. And so I like to see cats in separate kennels if possible, but if that's not a possibility, get a larger dog size kennel that can hold a dog or a cat, a big cat bed, and a small litter box so that they have a place to go. We don't want them being loose in the car because they can get under seats and all kinds of places. So, have a kennel that's big enough that they can roam around and have toilet facilities. traveling, you're going to have to make sure that you plan ahead for hotels that accept pets. Make sure that they are on flea medication before you go down there, because if you're staying in hotel rooms that allow pets, you don't know about the pets that were there before, and you don't want to be having them pick up parasites while you're in a hotel. Plus, Florida, very different climate than what we have here. They have a year-round flea problem. They also have heartworm. And so this would be something to talk to your veterinarian about, getting your kitties on a medication. And the couple that I like to use in cats, because you don't have to pill them, there's one called Revolution that's a spot-on flea and heartworm prevention that just goes on the skin on their back. And there's another one called Advantage Multi that has other effects as well. It gets other intestinal parasites and ear mites, and Revolution does some of that as well. But those would be two that you could use very easily, because we want your cats to not be coming back with things from down in Florida. So it does take planning. You will need a health certificate, because that's the law for crossing state boundaries and things. Make sure that you talk to your veterinarian about getting a health certificate as well.
Okay. A few things to think about there, Pam.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
It's not as easy just throwing them in the car. You got to really plan ahead when you're traveling with pets.
Sue in Milwaukee up next. Hi, Sue.
Hello, Larry and Dr. Sawcheck. I have a broad-based question that I've been wondering about for quite some time, and that is, I've been to the country of India several times doing volunteer work, and while there, I have visited animal sanctuaries, specifically with regard to dogs, and I'm sure you're well aware of the heartbreaking conditions of dogs in India. I've gone around, as they've fed packs of emaciated dogs rice, and they all come out, and it's just heartbreaking. And I keep hearing about these efforts to have a pill or a shot to spay or neuter dogs, but yet I don't know if there's any progress on that front. Mm-hmm. Do you have any information about that?
Yeah. Well, for dogs, for male dogs, there is an intratesticular injection that can be done that will sterilize them, does not remove all of their testosterone, so they may have some virility, meaning that they may still mark and want to mate, but they will be sterile. But it does require that they be sedated to be able to get that injection, but it is a permanent thing. And veterinarians, if it's going to be used in this country, have to go through certain training to be able to do it correctly. But it does require the dog to be either heavily sedated or under anesthesia for obvious reasons. They are trying to come out with some vaccines to sterilize female dogs. And I'm not a reproduction specialist, but I believe they're like an anti-gonadotropin releasing hormone vaccine that is not going to be a permanent solution. It has to be readministered at certain times. So it's not like one and done, where you give the injection, you don't have to worry about them for the rest of their life. So, there are things that are being developed. There are things that are already out there, but nothing is perfect. And it comes down to, in those situations, trapping, spaying and neutering, and then re-releasing them is similar to what we're doing in this country for like feral cat control. That's a very common practice in this country to be able to get them. That's why you'll see these cats that have a corner of their ear taken off. Those are cats that have been trapped, spayed, neutered, and then released, and so that at a distance you can say, oh yeah, or if they're trapped again, they've already been taken care of, and we can let them go again because that's the surgery's already been done. And there are many organizations that are now going out and doing this kind of thing around the world. Sometimes it's just we're just trying to get rabies vaccine into animals, and there's the huge push to do that on a worldwide basis as well, not only for the pets' protection, but for human protection as well. And that's even difficult, to be able to get all of these animals vaccinated. So you can imagine the amount of human resources it would take to be able to manage something like this, whether it's just trapping them and injecting them or actually doing the surgery.
Yeah, it'd be nice if you had something you could put in that food when you go to feed them. That would take care of everything.
Would be nice to have a birth control pill like that, but is there any guarantee that they're going to be taking it? It's the tough situation to be in.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks so much for that call, Sue. Appreciate it very much. We have Aaron in Grafton up next. Hi, Aaron. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. A little background. I have a 17-year-old cat. She was spayed in March because she had where her uterus was filling up with fluid. I forget what they call it. But so she was neutered because of that. She never had kittens. But now she's developed since September. I have been taking her into the vet numerous times. She has a urinary tract infection. I don't know if those two are connected or not, but she had different kinds of E. coli in her urinary tract infection, and I have been treating her with a variety of antibiotics. You know, they'll do a culture, they'll tell me what the what works best for that, and I'll do that, and then I'll bring her in 2 or 3 weeks, however long, and they'll say, okay, well, now that one doesn't work, but this one, this antibiotic will work, and I do that, and then I bring her back in 2 or 3 weeks, and they go, okay, that one's not going to work anymore.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm back to here. I'm back to the original one where we did a shot for 10 days. I forget the antibiotic that it's a shot.
Uh-huh.
And then, and now also Clavamox. But that's what we originally started out to be. And that's the one that they say now this is is the best for this one. So, in the meantime, you know, she's still eating and drinking and stuff like that, but I can tell she's not feeling good. And,
You know, when we have recurrent urinary tract infections, regardless of the age of the animal, we always want to make sure that it is, you know, whether it's recurrent or persistent. Okay. So, sometimes checking while they're on antibiotics, a urine culture is helpful because do they still have bacteria there while they're still on the antibiotic? Or, you know, are they just getting it back again very quickly after they go off of it? So sometimes it takes, you know, doing, you know, treatment, you know, while they're on treatment, getting cultures done. We also want to look for an underlying cause for this as well, because, you know, the bladder is pretty good at keeping, you know, bacteria out and just allowing urine to form and out it comes. But sometimes when we have things like a bladder wall tumor, wherein if we have a stone in there that is a nidus of infection, then as soon as you treat them, it's going to come back again. And so diagnostic work that's involved, besides doing the cultures like your veterinarian's doing, and maybe culturing more frequently while they're on treatment, may involve doing some imaging of the urinary system to see, you know, do we have anything abnormal in there? And that would include things like getting an abdominal ultrasound done, maybe doing some contrast radiology where they give some contrast material and actually see it in the bladder so that they can outline things that don't belong there. So that's what they would be looking for in this case. We also want to make sure that there isn't some underlying health reason why your cat may be having this. Things like diabetes, that because they have so much sugar in their urine, it can, you know, be a nice food for bacteria to grow on, that they don't have underlying kidney disease where the urine is more dilute, which predisposes them to urinary tract infections. And so sometimes getting blood work done is really helpful in these cases as well. So, you know, again, I would not having the medical record there to see exactly what they've done. I'm kind of talking off the top of my head, but I think rather than just keep treating and treating, it may be time, if they're not comfortable with doing ultrasound or contrast studies, time to refer to somebody that does do that kind of thing. And there's places all over the state, including the vet school in Madison, we're able to get that kind of stuff done for you to be able to make sure that your cat lives its senior years healthy and happy and not with an uncomfortable bladder problem.
Yeah.
I did have blood work done, and she doesn't have any underlying stuff. Her kidneys don't look well. I mean, she's got phosphorus has risen since, but she was just on sulfa drugs, which are kind of hard on the kidneys.
Yeah,
But we have been taking it. We have been taking urinary or urine samples while she's still on the drug.
Okay.
So the first time we didn't, but after that we've been taking it while she's still on the drug. You know, maybe the last day. You know, and it then changes to a different E. coli or something that needs a different kind of drug. So
time for imaging. Yeah, she needs to have some stuff done to look for a nidus of infection, and that's your next step if they haven't done that yet.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org, and we had some nice photos up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We've got one beautiful photo. My dog, Rainey, is an 8-year-old border collie. The maple tree. Oh, isn't that a pretty picture?
Oh, that's beautiful. That's like calendar worthy right there.
Yeah, the maple trees held onto their leaves till the first hard frost and then dropped them all at once. And that made a beautiful background.
That's a lovely, lovely picture. And the dog's actually smiling.
Yeah.
You see that? That's a beautiful picture.
Thanks, William, for sending that. And Tom sent one, too, our 2.5-year-old rescue hound. His name is Augie. He's a fantastic house pet and companion. Another beautiful photo.
And you know what I like to see there? That dog is wearing a harness that I really like. They're called the Easy Walker Harness. And anybody that has a dog that pulls a lot, this is something that a lot of trainers are recommending that people go to. It goes around behind the shoulders and behind the, like around the chest, and there's a strap that runs forward, and that's where the leash attaches. And it works very differently than regular harnesses where it pulls on the back, where the dog, that's what they use for sled dogs, so they can continue to pull, and it kind of stops pulling, and it's nice to see that the dog's got a collar on, probably holding the ID, and then that wonderful harness so that they can get out and exercise and yet maybe not be such a puller.
You want to see that? Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Paula in Eau Claire has a question for you, Sandy. Let's go there. Hi, Paula. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 16 or 17-year-old cat we adopted. We adopted him 16 years ago. Not sure on his age at that time, but he was fairly young. About 10 days ago, my son had him holding him, and we put him down. He freaked out. And we watched him, and we realized he was blind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seemed like, you know, it just happened.
Yeah.
So I took him to the vet, and he checked everything out. He says he seems really healthy. He wasn't concerned about the eyes, like if there was any bleeding or anything. He tried to do a blood pressure test.
Okay.
I guess it's extremely hard to do on cats. But he said he thought he was had high blood pressure and gave me a medication to give him.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm concerned about his quality of life. He seems fine. He's eating, he's drinking, he's getting around the house. He's not happy that he can't go down in our basement because I'm afraid there's just too many things.
Right, right.
Happen to him. But
what do we do in a situation like that to make the kitty
more comfortable? Yeah, and I'm so glad that your veterinarian did blood pressure. That's probably the leading cause of acute blindness in senior cats is being hypertensive. And unlike in people where we can just be, you know, healthy as can be and have what's called essential hypertension where there's no underlying cause, you just happen to be genetically primed to have it. In cats and dogs, we usually have an underlying medical problem. And for cats, probably the number one thing is kidney disease. And getting blood pressure can be done. It actually is quite simple. If you have a cat that's relaxed, and we use little itty bitty cuffs, just like they use, they're human pediatric blood pressure cuffs that we use in cats. And so they're very small. We measure the leg with a little tape measure, put this cuff on, and instead of using a stethoscope, we use something called a Doppler, which we put over a blood vessel in their foot, just above their foot. And that is able to broadcast the sound of the blood flowing through the blood vessels over a speaker. And so we're able to, when we pump up the cuff, hear it stop, the blood flow stop. And so we're able to get systolic blood pressure measured. Not very good at getting diastolic blood pressure measured. And normal blood pressure for cats, usually about 120, just like it is for us. When it gets over 160, we really worry. Most times, cats start losing their vision when it gets over 200. So, I wish we could have had a blood pressure measured on your cat, because that's going to be probably the key to be able to get your cat treated, because we don't want to have this cat staying in a persistently hypertensive state, because other things can happen as well. I think the big things is, you know, making sure that your cat is in a more restricted environment like you're doing, easy access to the litter boxes. You may have to have them in a situation where they're in, confined to a room where they don't have far to go to be able to get to the litter box and have their food. Don't startle them when they're sleeping. Maybe make a sound or a vibration that the cat can feel so that they know that you're approaching. They can hear it. It's just a matter of trying to not startle your cat. If your cat was an indoor outdoor cat, obviously that has to change as well. But it sounds like your vet's right on the ball and managing your cat as best as they can. But I'd also be probably wanting to do some blood work to see, does your cat have underlying renal disease, which may need to be managed with special diets, the phosphate binders, extra potassium, those types of things. And so that may provide your cat with a better quality of life as well.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you'll tune in to the Ideas Network on Thanksgiving Day for our holiday specials at 10, America's Test Kitchen Talks Turkey. Then at 11, the Splendid Tables Live Turkey Confidential helps you make your turkey. And later on at 1, relax with the best of the best Third Coast Audio Festival winners. That's our Thanksgiving Day holiday lineup. That's Thursday starting at 10 on the Ideas Network. So right now, though, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, and we will turn to Kate in Fox Valley next. Kate, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a story to tell about a mixed breed dog from a local shelter, and I guess I'd like the doctor's reaction. This dog, I think a Spaniel Husky mix, for the first 3 years of his life, I struggled with him with intestinal issues. The poor guy, I just could not figure out with the help of my vet what was producing apparent pain and diarrhea and sometimes in extreme cases vomiting. These episodes were recurrent. Went through everything with my vet, including surgery. I had my dog surgery so that his entire intestinal tract could be biopsied. So eventually this last summer in June, when I was at the end of my rope, I had a kind of an aha moment and connected some dots thinking, I think maybe it's rice. Maybe he's having trouble digesting rice. And, of course, rice is a main ingredient in all the healthy treats I was giving him. And brewer's rice was the main ingredient in the hydrolyzed protein diet that I was starting him on, and it wasn't helping. The upshot is I took rice out of my dog's diet completely, and he's better. And I don't know if that makes sense to the doctor. I think
I think my vet thought I was crazy.
No.
You know, but...
what do you think, Sandy?
Yeah, I mean, grains as a food allergen are uncommon. It doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, but it sounds like you went through everything. And going to a hydrolyzed protein diet is obviously going to rule out what they do is they take protein and break it down into amino acid bits where the patient's gut isn't going to recognize where it came from. And so a lot of these are usually chicken-based diets, but they're, you know, you're not going to have a reaction to it because the dog doesn't know where it comes from. But if they have a grain allergy, then obviously some of these diets can potentially be a problem. And although rice is usually well-tolerated, that's very possible that your dog had a rice allergy. And so I'm so glad that you got some answers for that. And that's when it comes down to you just start playing. And we sometimes have to go with homemade diets and things to be able to weed out what is in there and trying to find, you know, the right combination of things that will work for your dog. And you're right, it is one of those ingredients that's included in many of the prescription diets and or therapeutic diets that we use. And it's also in a lot of treats. And we look at it as being very healthy, and it usually is extremely well tolerated. But I am just so grateful that your dog now has, you know, that comfort of not having diarrhea and gastric distress and so on. And but it's, you know, I wish it could be that simple for everybody. Well, it wasn't. You had 3 years of trying to work with your dog, so obviously it wasn't that simple. But I'm glad that you went ahead and decided, let's just eliminate that. The blood tests that we can do for food allergies are extremely unreliable. And I know I have people asking me all the time, why can't we just do a blood test? Why do we have to do a food trial? And it's because the results that we get from those for food allergies are really bogus, and it doesn't help very much. So you did the right thing, and I'm glad it worked out for your dog. So
Thank you so much for calling and sharing that. That's long time to have to deal with that, but Kate did the right thing for sure. Pam in Appleton has something for us. Pam, hello.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling about Mr. Wiggles. He's our 12-year-old cat, and he had an odontogenic tumor upper right side of his jaw. Because we love him very much and because he's very healthy and active, we decided to go ahead and proceed with the hemimaxillectomy surgery, which he had back in May. He came through the surgery. The surgeon got clean margins all around. He created a flap over what was the hole in his upper palate, but it failed and necrosed. Along with some of the skin on his cheek so he still has a hole in his upper palate, and after, you know, follow up, basically the surgeon said, you know what, he's going to end up, you know, this is pretty much the rest of his life. Wiggles had an esophageal feeding tube for several months, but it kept getting infected. And honestly, Wiggles wanted to eat. He wanted to be a cat again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we were told just let him go ahead and eat. What he does is he sneezes a lot after he eats because I guess, you know, stuff gets up there and he sneezes it out.
Mm-hmm.
But he hasn't gained back his weight. He was a pretty big guy, actually. He was a little overweight when this all started. He was like 16 plus pounds.
Mm-hmm.
He's down to 10 something. You know, we did our best with the feeding tube, but honestly, you know, he lost weight over the course of all of this.
Yeah.
I recently took him back to his regular vet because he's not gaining back the weight, and I, you know, was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
His X-rays were all normal. His blood work was normal. Kidney, liver functions, they're all great. His potassium, I guess, was a little low, but other than that, everything was completely normal. So I wanted to make sure he didn't have, like, metastasis or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
So anyway, the bottom line is, what I I'm trying to figure out is what can we feed him that will, like, boost him on calories?
Yeah, that's a really tough one because, you know, one, I would get a second opinion as regarding the what we call an oral nasal fistula. You can imagine if we had a hole in the roof of our mouth, every time we would eat or drink, stuff would go up into our nasal passages and how irritating that can be. At the vet school, we have oral surgeons that's all they specialize in is doing dental procedures and oral facial surgery like that. And so that might be a place to go look and just get a second opinion as to whether this would be something that can be fixed. I would hope that the lab work that was done also looked at thyroid levels because many cats that are hyperthyroid, and it usually happens when they're like 8+, will start, you know, continue to lose weight, and it's difficult to keep weight on them. You know, I think that, you know, there are high calorie diets that you could use. It may be the texture of the food that you're using that you might have to be looking into changing. So going with some of these, you know, really high calorie foods that are, you know, I call it the rocket fuel in a bag type foods. And this is where you would have to go on to websites like petobesityprevention.com where they have all of the calories listed for canned and dry and try to go with some of the higher ones that are out there may be helpful. But I really think trying to get this fistula fixed is going to be in his best interest. And it may just mean a different set of eyes from a different surgeon to be able to get it under control.
Yeah, and maybe 10 pounds isn't a bad weight for that cat.
That might be absolutely normal for him. That sounds like a pretty normal weight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. We have a photo from Adam, 2-year-old puppy Zoe. She just got the Lyme vaccination a couple of weeks ago and the booster yesterday. She is very lethargic and had some muscle spasms to the point that her back legs just kind of fell out from under her.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this would be something I'd be talking to your veterinarian about. She could be having a little vaccine reaction. It may just be kind of local pain from the injection site, and she may benefit from being on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, kind of like us taking something after a vaccination makes us feel a little bit better. So
yeah.
Give the vet a call.
Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Then we will be back with Dr. Sandy. Stay with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, talking about your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Lines are all filled. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo and question on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love those photos. Chantel in Milwaukee, thank you so much for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was calling because I just adopted a kitten. I actually found him in the ditch. He was a stray kitten. He was about 8 weeks old. And I took him in for a wellness check, and they had found a mite in his stool sample, and they said it was like Demodex, mm-hmm. apparently, so it's a skin parasite. But they said it didn't look like either the cat eye or the goat eye. I don't know if I'm saying that correct, but it didn't look strongly like either. But from what I was researching, the cat eye one, I think, is a little bit deeper in the skin, whereas the goat tie one might be more on the surface of the skin than it could be in his stool.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you know anything about these mites. I'm just a little concerned because I know the cat tie seems a little bit more severe, as it could mean an immune deficiency of some sort, whereas the goat tie maybe doesn't mean that. Do you have any information on those mites?
Yeah. What you're talking about is a small microscopic parasite. The most common one that we see in cats is one that's called Demodex gattoi, which is what you've been saying. And it's a small, kind of short, cigar-like mite that lives, like you said, a little more superficially. It makes cats itchy. They often groom themselves. We have a difficult time sometimes finding these parasites. We'll do skin scrapings, kind of like wide areas where we'll try to collect kind of superficial cells and material from the skin and have a look at it. But often we do find them in the stool sample because the cat's grooming themselves and they don't get digested and they come out in the stool sample. That, you know, regardless of what type of mite it is, and they can always send a stool sample to a veterinary parasitology lab and they can identify what the mite type is, they're both treated exactly the same. And so we typically put these kitties on, you know, we use something called a lime sulfur dip is the thing that is used in these cats. And it's pretty smelly. We also use it for treating ringworm, but it is the treatment of choice for treating these parasites as well. And so I'm not sure if your veterinarian has recommended treatment, but it's something that you probably are going to want to do eventually. It's one of the leading causes where we see cats kind of barbering their hair coat, where they have just their skin may look normal, but they just have areas of hair loss where they've over-groomed themselves. And so, you know, even if your cat has normal-looking skin, because this happens to be a mite that can be contagious from cat to cat, the gattoi type mite. If you do plan on ever boarding your cat or taking your cat where other cats may be, it's really important that you get this under control because you don't want to be spreading this to other kitties.
Okay, and is it transmittable to my dogs? I do have two dogs.
No, this is a mite that is only in cats. It is not transmissible to people or to dogs, but it is highly contagious between cats. So that is, and that's very different than the other type of Demodex, which is the kind that we see in dogs, and we can see it in cats as well. And you're right, it is usually means that they have some type of immunosuppressive type problem. They're bigger mites, they're much longer bodied, it's something that, again, is, you know, a cat mite or a dog mite, but not contagious between animals. And so we see it transmitted when puppies and kittens are babies from the parents, because it's kind of a mite that everybody has at low levels, and it can be transmitted when they're newborns, but we don't see transmission after that.
There
so
we
this
go.
Is not something that he'll get over on his own, correct?
If it is gattoi, he needs to be treated. And so I jump on that right away rather than waiting until his skin's miserable.
Yeah.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Dennis in Nisida, thanks for calling.
Hey, not a problem. I have 11 cats at home, and they love being in their carriers and everything. We leave the doors open on them when the carriers are in the house and everything like that. We travel with them. My 3-year-old male is the only one that will meow or anything without his door open. He travels with his door open, but he stays in his crate. All the other cats we have, they prefer staying in their crate, even in the house, to sleep and everything, because it's like a little cave.
Huh. Well, that's great that you have them out and they are comfortable in their crates. It does make traveling so much easier. I'd still be really worried about your cat in the car with the door open. If something startles them, they may escape. If you get into a little fender bender, now the cat has an escape route and you may lose your cat. And I've seen this happen. I've had people get out at rest stops and they think the cat is like safely hiding under a seat or something, and boom, the cat takes off and they've lost their cat and they can't find it. And so, yeah, I'd rather find other ways of dealing with the meowing, whether it be some, you know, natural calmatives like feel away, putting a blanket over the carrier, rather than leaving the door open when you're traveling.
But it's nice to have those carriers open at home.
Oh, yes, definitely. Having the carriers open at home is a great idea, because that gives the cats a nice little safe resting area that they can be in, and it does make travel to the vet a little bit easier because they now know the crate is wonderful and a safe place to be.
Thanks again, Dennis, for calling. Appreciate your call. John and Shano is up next. Hi, John.
Oh, hi, guys. How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, in my little house up here in Shawano, I own one dog, Stella, and I feed three cats, kind of like on that last call. One does not own a cat. One just feeds the cat. Anywho, but I do have a doggy door fenced in yard, which does not keep the cats, at bay whatsoever. I think what I have is a flea problem. Stella dog, born on my living room floor, unbeknownst to me, I took home a dog home from a construction job I was working at, and 3 weeks later, I'll pop 9 puppies. Anyway, my fault. But anywho, so Stella is, she won't turn 10 until March. She has never had a problem with fleas, and I think it is probably a flea issue, but now she is really sore, and I've given her one flea bath, one medicated bath a week after that, swept and mopped, vacuumed, no carpeting in the house.
Well, I'm going to give you a little rundown on fleas, okay? This is the fact that the most common animals that are carriers of fleas that are going to infest your yard that then dogs get exposed to are cats, raccoons, and possums. And obviously the wildlife, they're going to be coming by at night. Fleas lay eggs about the size of a grain of sugar, and they roll off and can hatch in the environment into a immature flea that hasn't fed. Your dog walks by, they jump up on your dog, and we start the whole cycle over again. And you've had 10 years of good luck without having fleas, but this has been such a very prolonged season this year that we're seeing more and more cases of animals with fleas even now. And just remember, the fleas that you're seeing on your pet today are from eggs that were laid a couple of months ago. And so they probably picked them up outside, brought them in, and now your home is infested. And just because you don't have carpeting doesn't mean you can't have a flea-infested home. Those eggs, like I said, are about the size of a grain of sugar. They're going to roll off and get down into cracks in the floorboards, under baseboards, and be in areas like that, where they hatch into a larva, then into a cocoon stage. And, again, they, can sit there in the cocoon stage for a fairly long period of time, sometimes up to months if it's not the right conditions for them to hatch. And, they hatch out again and you start the cycle over again. So the important thing for dealing with fleas is bathing is only going to remove the fleas on the pet. And if you look at fleas as kind of like this big pyramid, the adult flea is at the top of the pyramid, and you've got hundreds of thousands of eggs and other immature stages at the bottom of the pyramid. And so you have to have your pet on a good flea control agent that is going to kill fleas as soon as they hatch and are up, jumping up on the pet, for a minimum of 2 to 3 months. And that means all the three cats and the dog, anybody that's coming in and out of your house, needs to be on an effective flea control agent. And that means either some of the oral products that are licensed for dogs now, or the spot-on products like Advantage Multi or Revolution, Frontline, those types of things. Some of the products you can get over-the-counter, some you need to get from your vet. Do not buy the inexpensive over-the-counter flea and tick drops. They do not work very well and have a high toxicity rate. Just because they're available over-the-counter doesn't mean that they're safer than what you can get through your veterinarian. Vacuuming your house is going to be really helpful. It'll help suck up the flea eggs that may be there, some of the flea droppings, which is digested blood that is feeding the larval stages, may cause some of those fleas that are in that cocoon stage to hatch, and you may vacuum them up again. But that's not the only thing you need to do. You really need to treat all of the pets. And your dog that's miserable from fleas may need to be on some medication to help stop the itch as well. They can get secondary bacterial and yeast infections, and they may need to be on something to get that under control too. And be aware that fleas can carry tapeworms. And a few months from now, you may start seeing your pets passing tapeworm segments, and they may need to be treated for that as well. So it's a long, drawn-out process. But compared to what we used to do with bombing homes and hiring exterminators, with the products that we have on the market now, you can really get by with just having the pets be the flea catcher with kind of minimal environmental control by vacuuming, and you'll have your pets feeling more comfortable very, very quickly.
And there's a different treatment for the cat versus the dog.
You got it. The dog treatments, remember, dogs and cats have very different tolerances for certain chemicals, and even though it may be the same chemical, it may be cats may need a different dose than the dog, so don't use dog products on cats or vice versa. And I would definitely be consulting with your veterinarian and making sure that you've got the correct weight, the correct products that you can use, and it's well worth it to use something that is available from a professional rather than just trying to pick and choose over the counter.
Would you be concerned about, let's say, the cat and the dog lays together?
If you have a product that is, there are certain products that we can use on dogs that are toxic for cats. And so if you've got the dog and the cat being really good friends, and you happen to use one of these products that maybe contains permethrin, which would include Advantix, Vectra 3D, there's a number of them out there, that can be transmitted to the cat, and enough that the cat, if they groom themselves, could become toxic. So you have to know kind of how close these animals interact, and that would be, again, something that your veterinarian could help you with, picking and choosing the right product for kind of a mixed species population to get it under control.
There we go. Thanks so much for calling. I want to give Elizabeth in Oshkosh a chance to join in as well. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sandy. Thanks for your informative show. It's awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listen, I have a 22-year-old son who's a senior in college who was recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And he is having, obviously, trouble with keeping his blood sugar under control. What I'm looking for is possibly finding a scent-trained dog for low blood sugar, for hypoglycemia. I wondered if you could direct me within the state. I've tried one place outside of La Crosse, and I'm wondering other places that might be have reputable, you know, animals that might be scent trained.
Yeah, have you looked with like the American Diabetes Association, like contacted them to see if they have resources regarding service dogs?
I haven't in our state, but that's probably a very good
idea.
That
would be my first place to go, because obviously this is a very specialized trained dog. And, you know, we have hearing ear dogs, we have seeing eye dogs, and it's, you know, again, although they're not that common, it's pretty easy to find places where you can have these dogs that are trained. But having dogs to be trained for epilepsy detection and blood sugar detection and that type of thing is much more specialized, and you may have to go out of state to be able to find an appropriate dog. They are out there. Have I had the opportunity to work with any of them? No, I haven't, but I do know that it's just amazing the abilities of what we have when we have dogs available to do this type of thing. And I mean, they're now being trained to diagnose cancer and all kinds of things like that. And so I know they're out there, but I don't have a location to actually send you to. But I would start with the American Diabetes Association and just see if they may be able to have some assistance for you.
Yeah.
Great. I have one further question. Do you know, do they always start with puppies, or could you take, we have two labs and one is young. Is that something that we might have done with one of our dogs?
They can be trained. I think the big thing with service dogs is it's not just training them to be able to do the job that they need to do, whether it's being a seeing eye dog or hearing ear dog or whatever, but also being able to be comfortable in social situations, because this dog goes obviously everywhere, on airplanes, on buses, in, you know, theaters and restaurants, and, you know, it's always with people and has to be a well-mannered, well-trained dog that knows how to behave in all those situations. So it's not just training them for their purpose, but also getting all that very early training done. And that's why we see people, we have a couple of students right now that are going through, you know, they have a service dog in training with them, and they come to the vet school and sit in classes and go to labs with them and are learning to, you know, be quiet in situations like this and, you know, being in crowds and all kinds of situations. situations, that's that first year or so of their life, and then they go on to the specialized training. So you potentially could train your dogs to be able to do that, but it's going to take working with a professional. Obviously, I'm not able to help you with how to even go about starting to do something like this, but I think if your dogs meet the kind of social criteria, then the next step would be to find someone to help you with the training.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're
Thanks
welcome.
So much for calling. Christina emailed to ask how she can boost her cat's immune system. Her cat has been FIV positive since birth. She gives her scoops of lysine powder. What else can she do?
Yeah, FIV is like our human HIV, and it suppresses the immune system. Many cats can live with it for the great majority of their life without having any trouble. The big thing is making sure that they are kept indoors, not getting into fights with other cats, not being exposed to different viral or bacterial infections that could potentially harm their health. Keeping them on a good, well-balanced diet is important. So making sure that, you know, they're getting all the right vitamins, minerals, nutrients, and so on. Keeping also the cat's oral health under control, which means brushing their teeth, using, you know, dental control, dental tartar and plaque devices. Probably the best place to be able to look for what works well for cats and dogs is the Veterinary Oral Health Council. It's called VOHC.org. They have approved products, things that they've looked at the research and actually put their seal of approval on it. And there's products for dogs, products for cats, including diets and toothpastes and rinses and treats and so on that make life a little bit easier if you can't be in there brushing. But that's probably the biggest source of bacteria for a lot of these cats. And we see many of them with chronic kind of oral infections that can be spread elsewhere in the body. So keeping that mouth healthy is really important.
A nice photo here on our Facebook page from Anne. This is our beloved 11-and-a-half-year-old English bulldog, Rosie, celebrating her 11th birthday. She has issues, is well-treated, of course, but maintains a huge zest for life and believes herself to be a wolf when she's taken for a walk.
Oh, my goodness. You know, bulldogs, their life expectancy is not as long as other breeds, and we typically see them, you know, when people ask me, I mean, obviously I've had them for years, usually 10 years we start seeing them not living that long. But Rose looks like she's an absolutely wonderful dog. And what I like to see is this is a bulldog, and just looking at her from here, even though her chest is pretty wide, it looks like she's got a waist. And that's probably one of the big things that we see with bulldogs, because they don't exercise as well with their breathing disorders. They put weight on, and that's probably the thing that causes them to have so many orthopedic and health issues. I see a waist on that bulldog, and I would bet that she's in pretty good body condition for a senior girl. So keep up the good work, and send us another birthday photo in a year. I want to see that.
And Sarah sent a nice photo of her 3-year-old Pomeranian. Oh, my goodness, that's a pretty little dog as
well.
Oh,
my goodness. The coat care for something like that. You know, these little dogs, wonderful little dogs, lap dogs, probably the big thing that we see with them is dental issues, because they've got all the teeth that a big dog has in a very tiny mouth with very little bone attachment. So these are dogs that I spend a lot of time teaching owners how to brush their teeth and do that oral care, because we see them losing their teeth very, very early in life unless they have the owner that's really dedicated to keep that mouth under control.
Teresa and Adams called to say she's getting a kitten as a barn cat, wants to know how she should care for the kitty over the winter.
Well, she's getting a kitten that's going to be outside in the barn. There are plans that you can get online for making insulated kitty houses that will provide the cat with a warm place to be able to go. And I think that's really helpful. Many humane societies and feral rescue groups will have people making these and donating them for situations like this. If you've got stray cats or feral cats, to be able to keep them healthy. I think the big thing for this kitty is making sure that it's healthy and happy before it is left, you know, outside. So not parasitized, no ear mites, no upper respiratory infections, well vaccinated, so that you've got a good start on having this cat being a functional member of your barn crew.
And with that, we are out of time, Sandy. It's always a pleasure. You're going to be back on December 27th, a couple of days after Christmas.
After Christmas, yes, yeah. And you know, it goes so fast, but it's so much fun. It was a great show.
Thank you so much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. And she'll be back on December 27th, and we will do this all over again. Oh, boy, that was lots of fun. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's just the way it always works. Just looking ahead, tomorrow at this time, we'll be talking about the Great Lakes Restorative Initiative, and we'll catch up with news from the Mississippi River as well. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.